Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial, but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological, and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcast offers. I dare you.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir. Coming up, David Cameron's leadership is being questioned by chippy backbenchers. Labour's two Eds are rumoured to be at loggerheads. And Nick Clegg is grabbing headlines as a one-man soak-the-rich policy unit. Yes, we're deep into the summer recess. But as we hurtle towards the autumn conference season, which leader has the tightest grip on his party? Also this week, mitts off. Romney begins his official run for the White House as the Republicans formally endorse their presidential candidate. But have they learned to love him? We'll hear from our man in Florida, where the party convention is in full swing. Joining me are columnist Polly Toynbee, political commentator Andrew Jimson, and down the line, our political commentator Michael White. A warm welcome to all of you. Westminster's awaking from its summer slumber, a cabinet reshuffle is on the horizon, and conference season is hoving into view. It's all the ingredients you need for a steady stream of stories about party splits, anonymous briefings, and inter-party rows. Clegg, Cameron and Miliband all head into September with questions surrounding their authority. We have our political agony aunt and uncles here, so let's start with David Cameron first. There he is, trying to build a strong relationship with his party, but there are these noises off. He's been accused in public this week of being a chambermaid to the Lib Dems, halfway between a man and a mouse, a pussyfooter, and a few weeks ago he was damned as a posh boy who doesn't care about ordinary people. So Andrew, how much discord is there at present in Project Cameron?
Well, there's enormous discontent among Tory backbenchers, particularly among the sort of golf club boors who backed David Davis for the leadership. They know they're never going to get jobs, and they can't. The only point of backing Cameron was the idea that he was a winner. He didn't win in 2010. 36.1% was a very, very mediocre result. If he can't convince them he's going to win in 2015, then they're certainly not going to remain loyal to him.
A week is a very long time in politics, and months are even more significant. But you say he only just won. He did win. He took them into government for the first time in many years. Is there no gratitude at all?
Not much, I don't think, because they hate the Lib Dems. Personally, I don't hate the Lib Dems, actually, but I find myself in a very small minority. Most people who have actually fought them on the ground do, because they say they're two-faced and all that. So, no, there is very little reserve of loyalty to fall back on. And this basic problem that Cameron hasn't given them a sense of direction. They don't feel they're heading somewhere where things are going to get better.
Mike White, there's always turbulence, but do you detect a coarsening in the language being used against Cameron by his backbenchers?
Yeah, it's pretty juvenile language, really, and it smacks of desperation. But they are in a difficult position. I've taken the view from day one, when I got over the shock of there being a coalition, that it would probably last the full 5 years, because I couldn't think of a better idea for those who'd got involved in this thing. You know, it's a bit like a Las Vegas marriage. You do it in haste and repent it at leisure. But it would be disastrous for the Lib Dems to walk out, but it wouldn't be great for the Tories either, because as you've said and Andrew's said with greater authority than me, Cameron's not very popular in the country. He's certainly not very popular with his own party. They're not sure what he stands for. And the wounding thing that Tim Yeo used this week, he said, you know, let's see if what sort of heart the Prime Minister has, a bit of Thatcher in it, an organ of which most party members know little. In other words, we don't know what Cameron really thinks. That's a damning thing to say. It's up to Cameron one way or another to prove them wrong, or alternatively, of course, to put the fear of God in them in some way. And he's a much meaner man than John Major, who had similar problems of party discipline. He's a tougher, nastier piece of work, I'm glad to say. So, that's an option.
Polly, this bad-mouthing seems to be coming from the right of the party, who feel that cuts haven't been made fast enough. Is that worrying for you?
Well, I think you can never underestimate the stupidity of Tory backbenchers, and they have played their hand incredibly badly. They don't seem to understand the nature of the game at all. It's partly that they are delusional. They simply don't realise that they lost the election or they failed to win the election. They need the Lib Dems. Their big mistake was to allow Nick Clegg to trash the boundary change. That really makes the big political difference. That was the big game for them. Makes a big difference. The difference between having to be 7 points ahead to get a majority and having to be 10 points ahead to get a majority. And they've lost that, unless, of course, Nick Clegg yet again caves in and gives them the boundaries.
But is that just lack of maturity on their part, then?
No, it's stubbornness in its conviction and its loathing of Lib Dems, loathing of constitutional changes of all kinds. I mean, they could have negotiated a reform of the House of Lords that would be more acceptable, I would have thought. They simply don't have their eye on the ball on the backbenches, partly for the reason Andrew said, you know, they're all the lot who are never going to get jobs and what's in it for them. And if they're sitting in a safe seat, maybe they don't care much about the boundary changes anyway. But for the future of their party, it matters a lot.
But Andrew, I mean, you don't hate the Lib Dems, and that's very big of you to say so. But surely they realise that without Lib Dems, they wouldn't even be in government.
Well, I think that is why the chances are that the coalition will endure, because neither of them have anywhere to go. You're right, the arithmetic was utterly clear. Cameron was quite popular to begin with, because by making this generous offer, or this unrefusable offer to the Lib Dems, he got them in, and he's destroying them. They are being wiped out. There's a very good piece in today's Guardian by Martin Kettle pointing out that the absolute hopelessness of their predicament.
Was that the plan?
So I think it was, because he's a liberal conservative, and he would. But the trouble is that wiping out the Lib Dems actually benefits Labour and possibly the Greens. There's not much sign yet that it's actually going to be of great electoral help to the Conservatives.
Except okay, that more of the Lib Dem seats will fall to the Conservatives, about 2-1, than fall to Labour. That's one of Labour's problems, and why they've got to rather want the Lib Dem vote holds up.
Mike, come in, Mike.
Well, if you're a Tory right-winger, you think, no, Cameron didn't have to form a coalition. If he could have done what Harold Wilson did in 1964, I know I'm showing my age, form what amounted to a minority government and wait until you've done a few popular things and then go for a general election in October 2010 or the spring of 2011 in the teeth of recession, when the theory on which the coalition is built, that you have to cut your way back into prosperity, hadn't yet been discredited as it now has been, and that's what they think he should have done. He should have kept his nerve. There's another problem. We haven't mentioned UKIP part of this. Disaffected Tories have somewhere to go, and Nigel Farage, the UKIP leader, is a craftier fellow than most of these guys who attack from the right, and you know, that flank is worrying, and it's not all about destroying the Lib Dems so it goes to Labour and the Greens. It could go to UKIP or even to something far nastier in the present mood of disaffection.
Interesting poll this week, though, shows that a YouGov poll showed that actually, rather surprisingly, few votes are heading towards UKIP.
Oh, I'd never read polls, do you?
Thank you, Mike. We'll keep on publishing them then. Well, you are all very skilled in relationships, so let's go around the table. What advice, Polly, would you give the Prime Minister in his present predicament?
Well, I would give him advice to say that it's all about the economy. He has a very short time, almost no window left at all, to U-turn on the economies. U-turn on everything else that matters much less, and to go a hell for leather for jobs and growth, and hope to God he can get some uptick in the economic figures by the time of the next election. Otherwise, he's totally sunk.
Andrew, what to do?
Well, there are no shortcuts to happiness, but Cameron has failed to show that we're all in this together. The danger for him is that he retreats. His problem already is that he's an establishment man, and he did what the cabinet secretary wanted and formed this coalition. He must get out and about and actually meet people who disagree with him. People don't like this emotionally inhibited, well-mannered English gentleman. He's got to somehow make, in a funny sort of way, he's got to be more open to people, even more vulnerable.
Mike, open your heart and tell us what David Cameron should do.
I don't think he should appear on Have I Got News For You. Polly's right, it's all about the economy. He can't do a U-turn and say, hey guys, I'm doing a U-turn. You have to make shifts sometimes, and that's okay, we all understand. You make them with conviction, you do them with grace, you even occasionally say, I was wrong. But in this case, it's so central to what he and George Osborne decided to do that fateful weekend in May and in the successive weeks, and he's bringing back David Laws, we read in the newspapers, may even be true, the Lib Dem, who was equally passionate about the austerity strategy. What he can do is trim it in different ways. He can find ways of pumping money into infrastructure projects. He can find ways of not slashing welfare payments and public expenditure in quite the enthusiastic way they want to. They won't be able to do it anyway, because the more they cut, the more Social Security payments and other benefits go up. So as we've seen in the last few months, public borrowing goes up anyway. And sooner or later, the wretched markets with their herd mentality will spot this, and then he's in more trouble. So he's got to execute a lot of pragmatic mini U-turns. He's got to keep putting money and demand into the economy, because that's the trouble, and he's got to generate with public seed corn confidence in the private sector, which will get them investing in the economy instead of sitting on the tons of money they've got.
Okay, well, we've done what we can for David Cameron. Let's move on to Nick Clegg. Pulled one way and then the other. He was quite sweet on David Cameron. Now he's not so sure. He had a good relationship with his party, but now they seem to like that Vince Cable a bit better than him. And the poll suggests certainly that the party might be wise to switch its affections. More brickbats today as well from the acerbic Lord Oakeshott. Mike, Nick
I never Clegg... feel the story is improved by the presence of Lord Oakeshott in
Well, indeed.
As for Vince Cable, I'm a fan of Vince, and I have to say right away, if I'm a fan of him, it's a really bad sign. He's unelectable. I learned that 30 years ago. Anybody I fancy, boom, doomed.
Polly, do you think that Nick Clegg talking about this tax on the wealthy, is that a sign of desperation, of him trying to nip and tuck and maybe soak up some of those supporters who actually like Vince Cable better than him?
Well, maybe, but it's also the right thing to do. And I think it was, you know, Labour was wrong-footed by not plunging in, saying yes, absolutely, in an unequivocal way. I think it's a good theme for them. I think they can say, look, we did let you cut income tax by about 5% for the top lot. And actually, tax on property is the one tax that really works, because you can't move a house to the Cayman Islands.
You can.
Well, it's quite difficult. It's quite difficult.
I'm afraid it isn't as difficult as it should be.
Well, you tax
put it
the
into
bricks
a company and then you sell the company to another company.
Yeah, but you don't. But that's already being somewhat curtailed. And I think you just don't. It doesn't matter whether it's the company that pays or the individual. The house pays.
You seem to know a lot about this, Mike. We'll have to look at your expenses again.
They're very good of you, Hugh. The trouble is, the Labour government tried to shut that particular loophole. It's very difficult.
Andrew, a lot of hostility from the Tory right. Is there sympathy for Nick Clegg too?
None that I've heard of.
Is that because you were in the wrong crowd?
No, he's not.
He seems to have a personally decent manners, doesn't he? And he did all right in the election because no one knew anything about him. And so he was the sort of neither Gordon Brown nor David Cameron candidate.
We all agreed with
that. Now that we do know more about him, we just don't think he's quite up to it, is he? He made this elementary mistake of not getting a proper job, and being Deputy Prime Minister isn't a proper job. He should be Foreign Secretary, or, you know, as the Liberals are in Germany. It's really, really bad that he's not. I mean, and then he gets obsessed by all this constitutional stuff, which, although it's of tremendous importance, is of no interest whatever to the man in the pub. So he has played his hand very, very badly.
Is the problem him as head of a concept, or is it personally him? Do they just like him because he embodies the coalition they don't want to be in? Or is it just because they don't think he's very good and don't like him?
Well, I think the whole of the political class has a problem. But although he went to Cambridge, he embodies this sort of, you know, they all read PPE at Oxford, and none of them has the faintest idea what it's like for ordinary people. And Clegg, I mean, I have absolutely no objection to people being from wealthy backgrounds, but he is from a wealthy background, and he somehow hasn't managed to transcend that.
What surprises me is just how badly he's played his hand. I didn't expect it, that he has thrown away everything that the Lib Dems really cared about, that he allowed Cameron, first of all, to call a referendum on the wrong kind of electoral reform, then allowed Cameron to oppose it, then allowed the Tory party to put £600,000 into the campaign against it in that where, you know, he should have said, at least you stand back and be absolutely neutral on this. There should have been stronger rules, and there might have been a chance of winning that. Then he's lost the Lords. I mean, what is there that he can walk away and say he's done? The very minor changes on tax are mostly the wrong ones. He's allowed huge cuts to the poorest, 18 billion, another 10 to come on welfare cuts. So his claim to, well, we've reduced tax a bit for some of the lower and middle earners, just doesn't cut it in comparison with that.
Mike, could he have played his hand better?
Well, two points to that. One is, you know, Polly's an enthusiast for constitutional reform. That's fine. So is Nick Clegg. It's a free country. But most people aren't, and they were on a hiding to nothing with that one, whichever way they sliced it up and whichever voting system they chose. Second point, the junior party in any coalition in any country, regardless of the voting system or the existence of the House of Lords, is usually onto a hiding for nothing. The Free Democrats, somebody mentioned them a moment ago, in Germany, are in big trouble and causing far more trouble for Angela Merkel, who's got a real problem on her hands, the euro, another pro-Nick Clegg policy, they're giving Miss Chancellor Merkel a much harder time. They get the blame. They have less power, the junior partner, and they tend to be blamed and they tend to be punished. It happened to the Greens in Wales at the last Welsh elections. They were in bed with Labour and they were punished for it. It happened to the Liberals in Scotland. That's the dynamic of it. And Clegg, he's a European politician, should have known.
Andrew, is David Laws the super ingredient here? If he brings back David Laws, or David Laws is drafted back in some way, does that improve the mix?
He had a very impressive ministerial career, but I can't remember how many days it lasted.
James Dean, isn't it?
best to die young, isn't it? I have a very high opinion of David Laws, but I don't think I think to describe him as the magic ingredient would be ridiculous.
People still seem to be talking him up as being, you know, the thing that could maybe just alter the alchemy a bit, so the coalition works better.
No, he hasn't got the personal touch either. No, he's a clever, decent fellow.
And there's another reason. As they go into the Lib Dem conference, David Laws is not the man to rally that party. Quite the opposite. I mean, David Laws is the man who proposed even more radical changes to the NHS than Andrew Lawrence. I'm so sorry.
I should say that Andrew Lawrence is not here to answer for himself. I think you meant Andrew Lansley.
That's who I meant. And I think that Laws represents, he is the Orange Book and represents strand in the Lib Dems that, you know, most of the people there at that conference are going to be absolutely rejecting.
OK, Mike, so...
Reminds me of last week's joke about Tony Blair. He's the only politician we know who's a Catholic but looks orange. Where were we?
Moving quickly along, what would your advice be for Nick Clegg?
I wouldn't start from here, but he is starting from here, poor chap. He's got an unfortunate public manner. Even the friendly interview on The Guardian this week, he sort of, even when making jokes, he sounded sort of slightly priggish, a bit like a Guardian leader on a bad day. And he can't cure that. He hasn't found a tone of voice with which to address people in a way which they find okay. Unfortunately, nor has David Cameron, although he's better than Ed Miliband or Nick Clegg, I suspect. None of them sound as if they connect with a whole mass of, we say, ordinary voters.
So what can he do?
Patronizing, but we know what he means. He's just got to sound a bit tougher in public. He's already learned that one. He's got to distance himself more and complain more, but he's stuck where he is, and he's got to go into that election, or until a very few months before it, as Deputy Prime Minister, I think. He's not going to be overthrown. Certainly, if he's the problem, Vince Cable is not the answer.
Andrew, what's your advice?
I think Vince Cable, if I was a Lib Dem, I'd definitely think there was some chance of rescuing themselves from this dreadful... I mean, they are being wiped out already at local level, and they will be wiped out at national level, or at least reduced to a sort of rump of about a dozen MPs at this rate. So I think they've got to try something new, and Nick Clegg is a vacuous, essentially a perfectly decent chap, but essentially a vacuous figure, and they've got to get rid of him.
They got down to six after the last coalition venture in 1945.
That's true.
So your advice is for Nick Clegg is head off into the sunset. Polly?
Yep,
I think I'd say the same too. I don't think it'll happen, but because very oddly, parties don't necessarily do what's best for them in the same way that Labour should have dumped Gordon Brown and gone with almost anybody else picked out of a hat, but they didn't. And so I think they'll probably plough on with Nick Clegg because the process of getting rid of somebody is so painful and so agonising that they won't.
Well, we were hoping to provide some reassurance for the party leaders, but in Nick Clegg's case, that doesn't seem to have happened, but we did try. Okay, Ed Miliband, he's looking for something long and lasting with his rank and file, but there's this other guy, Ed Balls, who just seems to complicate everything. Polly, the anonymous briefing seems to have re-emerged. How important is the relationship between Balls and Miliband?
I think it's very important. They don't need to love each other, but they need to get along just fine, and there needs to be a sense that Balls is not, a tiger waiting to spring, which I think, actually, he's not. And I think, oddly enough, for once in history, Labour looks much the most united of these three parties. I think that's the least of their problems. They've got lots of problems. What to say? What would you do about the deficit? We still don't know. All sorts of policy decisions they're going to have to make, not immediately, but soon. They're going to have to come up this autumn with one or two totemic policies so that you stop someone in the street, ask them what Labour stands for, they can at least think of something. So they've got other problems, but I really don't think it's a relationship problem.
Mike, is this real kind of summer silly season stuff, or is there real tension?
Nobody's briefed me anonymously. Where's this stuff coming from? What is the trouble between Balls and Miliband, except that obviously Balls thinks he could do the job much better, but nobody else does?
That's the theme of it, but we've heard it before, and it seems to be raising its head again.
Yeah, but where is it raising its head? You can name names.
Well, if you look at several newspapers, several political commentators seem to be being heavily briefed by presumably well-informed sources.
To take it from me, that's most unlikely to be the case. The trouble is with Balls is that he can't help it. He's a clever fellow, he's really smart, as he would be the first to admit under torture, and he's full of energy and full of ideas, but he was unable to clean the sheet over his central role as the brains behind Gordon Brown from 1997 to 2010. He's far more confidence than Brown ever had, and he'd have to, crawl on his knees through the snow for a month, and voters might be impressed by him saying, we got some things wrong, we borrowed too much money, we didn't rein in the banks, we didn't do this, we didn't do that, but he's incapable of saying that. And until he does, all his clever ideas, and lots of them, are good, and he's more right than wrong on the need to keep demand up in the economy, people aren't going to listen. And Ed Miliband is going to feel slightly overshadowed because he is a more restless, dynamic figure, Balls.
So, Polly, even if no one is dripping the poison into Mike's ear, what's your evaluation of where they are? Do they have a
Mike's
working
right.
relationship?
Yeah, I think they do. I think Mike's right. I don't hear any of this. I think this is summer invention. There was a poll that showed in one or two characteristics Balls was pulling, one or two points ahead of Miliband. It was just spun out of that nonsense, really, and I don't think it's there. I suspect that if Miliband were not to win the next election and were to stand down, Balls would actually think that Yvette was the next one up. So I think, I don't know that for certain, but I hear a lot of that being said. So
yeah, I think he might be halfway there to that conclusion too, a bit like Bill and Hillary.
Andrew Jimson, from your standpoint, is this all top entertainment? I think I saw in the Telegraph it described as being Balls is seen by Miliband's people as a control freak, and Miliband is seen by Balls' people as being a lightweight. All that kind of discord on the other side is quite good news for you.
I wouldn't regard it as top entertainment. I'd rather watch parades end, actually. But nor has any poison been dripped in even into my innocent ear.
But they know you're above those.
The fact that the dear old parliamentary lobby, of which Mike is such an adornment, is casting around and sort of seeing whether this story will fly or not is, I'm afraid, a reflection on Ed Miliband. He hasn't. I mean, he's quite entitled to treat it as a marathon rather than a sprint, but he hasn't yet established himself as a leader. He's still too obviously a policy wonk. Members of the public have barely heard of him, and they think he looks a bit of a sort of studenty type. He hasn't yet demonstrated any kind of capacity for taking bold or interesting decisions. So, of course, there will be discussion about his leadership because he hasn't yet. I mean, he quite likely he will, and in a sense, the pressure's off him because of the problems that the coalition's having. But he hasn't yet actually demonstrated that grown into the job and become a leader.
Perhaps he should boldly adopt the Mobot, M for Miliband, M for Mo, and, climb up on the back of Mo Farah's popularity.
But let's have a look at
this.
I was going to ask you for your advice, Mike, so we have it now. Thank you very much. Polly?
Let's have a look at this. Which party would you rather be now? Who looks as if they're going to be the bigger party at the next election? I think it's very hard to see any way in which the Conservatives could be the bigger party. Labour looks almost certain to be the bigger bigger party. The great unknown is what happens to those Lib Dem votes, where they go, how it falls out. Unless there's some sort of cataclysm between now and then, some assault on Labour or some brilliant success by the Tories, Labour are set to be the bigger party, and I'd rather be them at the moment.
And just very quickly, Andrew, what would you do or what would you advise for Ed Miliband's benefit rather than for your own?
It's a question of tone, isn't it? I think in his party conference speech, he doesn't have to be full of tremendously specific commitments about the tax system or anything else, but there has to be a sense of direction and a sense of authority, which has so far eluded him.
Okay, thanks for that. Well, let's leave that there because we're going to look across to Florida now, where there's another leader struggling to assert his authority. Mitt Romney has been officially nominated as the Republican candidate to take on Barack Obama for the presidency. Our man Ewan McCaskill is at the convention centre in Tampa, and I asked him if the party had taken their candidate into their hearts.
I was down in the convention floor, just talking to delegates, and there is a distinct lack of enthusiasm. People are very open about it. They say that he's stiff, he's wooden, a bit fuzzy, not excited by him. I mean, I was talking to one delegate from Texas. He was an African-American, which is very rare among Republicans. I was asking him how he expected the election to go, and he said, well, it's going to be tight, 50-50. But he said that the election wouldn't be a vote for Romney. If Romney wins, it will be because of the strength of the anti-Obama feeling. So that's not a very sort of positive thing to say at a Republican convention.
I thought the whole point was that once they had a candidate, they all got behind their man. Does this say something about the state of the Republican Party?
Exactly. You're exactly right. I mean, normally the convention, I mean, it's not a debate. It's not even remotely like conferences in Britain, although they tend to be fairly free of division these days. But it's just a showcase. And then normally you'd expect everybody to get behind the candidate. The keynote speaker last night was the New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, and he was supposed to talk up Romney. I think he was about sort of 17 minutes into his speech before he even mentioned the word Romney. And it ended up as more speech about Chris Christie than about Romney. It's been a bit of a disaster for Romney this week. I mean, this is his big chance to sort of sell himself to the American people, because he's still a sort of fairly unknown quantity. The first day, Monday, was cancelled because of the weather. Yesterday was the opening day, and it was incredibly flat and subdued. There was none of the sort of raucous jumping up and down you normally get at Republican conventions. The speakers were all fairly tame. There's just no excitement, no sort of sense of purpose. And as you said, it tells you something about the state of the Republican Party.
Ewan McCaskill in Tampa there. Well, they might not love him, but they'll rally round him eventually, won't they, Mike?
Ooh, not necessarily. It's a difficult one to call that. I don't think we can make any assumptions about parties and popularities and elections at the moment. Polly said, you know, Labour's going to be the biggest party after the election. Well, maybe, but it's a long way away. Republicans versus Democrats for the White House is the first Tuesday in November, not far away at all. Everything Ewan said was true. He's one of my favourite Scots, and he still hasn't acquired an American accent after 6 years in that country. I'm so disappointed that you know, they are unhappy about him. And those who are fired up by the selection of Paul Ryan as his running mate, it doesn't seem to have read across. Ryan made a speech which, according to the Guardian's account online today, you know, didn't greatly do the business, didn't mention Romney too much either, let alone Romney's religion, which is a real problem for many of the Republican base, because they don't really think of Mormons as Christians. The evangelicals don't. So all that's tricky. Obama ought to be dead meat with the economy where it is, but he's not, and he's a great campaigner. So, against my natural caution, some would say pessimism, I'm inclined to think he might get his second term, because we know Romney's a hopeless campaigner. We also know that middling voters, the independents as they like to call them, are scared of Paul Ryan's economic plans, his budget plans. Everyone says he's terribly clever, but his sums don't add up. And what we know about Republicans who say cut spending, cut taxes, they're much better at cutting taxes than they are cutting spending, which is why the United States deficit and historic debt has ballooned, mainly under Republican presidents. Don't forget that. It's Reagan, Bush Sr., Bill Clinton worked the debt down, got the budget into balance, and George Bush bumped it up again. And even most of Obama's budget troubles arise from the disastrous mismanagement of the economy under his less than talented predecessor.
Andrew and Downing Street, are they watching this with interest?
I'm sure they are. Of course, Romney's had that rather unfortunate visit to London quite recently, in which he showed his sort of amazingly hapless, cack-handed sort of way he deals with sort of perfectly obvious questions, in that case about the Olympics. He's a very embarrassing candidate, but it is just possible that people are too embarrassed to tell the pollsters that they are in fact going to vote for him because they think he's a businessman who knows how to sort out the economy. That could still conceivably be a
Ship
Trump.
The jobs
Trump.
Abroad.
Yeah.
Polly, if we look across the water, is there anything for us to learn from what's going on there?
No, I just think we get more and more baffled and amazed by American politics. We're always puzzled by it and astonished by the decisions that the Americans make time and again. Sometimes we're astonished by them suddenly electing Obama, which seems bizarre after the previous time they'd elected someone as dumb and as unprepossessing as George W. Bush.
No, the Supreme Court elected him.
Well, that's true. I think we look at Romney, we don't know much about him. We look at him, we look at that perfect all-American chisel face, and you think, God, he has got the face for the job. He's got the face that already looks as if it's carved out of the rock. And on the other hand, you think, Mormonism? Mormonism? Really? Buried gold plates? Jesus in America? I mean, it's
bonkers. Don't get Polly started on that one.
Bonkers religion. Yeah, it's quite true. But then you step back and you look at the others and they're all bonkers too. So maybe it's just because it's a more modern form of bonkers religion than others. So possibly.
It's value is entertainment value.
I think for us, we just, our mouth drops open when we look at American politics. And we hope to God we don't go too far that way ourselves.
Well, we'll have plenty to watch between now and November, but that's all we have for this podcast. And we'll be taking a short break for the Paralympics. Politics Weekly will be back in time for party conference season. Tom Clark will be here then, but that's all from me. My thanks to Polly Toynbee, Michael White and Andrew Jimson. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thank you for listening. And spare a thought for those party leaders. They're only human, you know.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcastoffers. I dare you.